Washington is sending nearly $4 billion of weapons to Ukraine, $4 billion of U.S. taxpayer money. It's not the only cost.
You know, we have to do a better job of watching where these weapons go and thinking about the long term.
Also today, if you're into big, action-packed, epic movies about medieval history, The Northman is for you. Filmmaker Robert Eggers took the time to make the smallest details precise.
He's simply a master in creating life in pictures in the movie. He's amazing.
And ready to pack your bags and finally take that long-delayed summer vacation? Two words, practice patience.
Though there is huge demand for travel, there aren't as many seats.
We've got some useful advice on that and rewriting the political history of the Philippines for the win. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us this Tuesday. More than 2 months now into the war in Ukraine, the big picture there is murky. In recent days, the Ukrainian military has launched a counteroffensive in the east to push Russian forces back from Kharkiv. That's Ukraine's second largest city and just 25 miles from the Russian border. Early on in the war, Russian forces launched a brutal assault on Kharkiv, rocketing residential areas and killing many civilians. But new reports describe Russian forces retreating from the region and blowing up bridges as they pull back. Reporter Volodymyr Solohub returned yesterday from Kharkiv. He's in Dnipro now, further away from those front lines. Volodymyr, Kharkiv has been an epicenter of the fighting for so long now. You just returned from there. What does it look like today?
Yes, Marco, we've been in Kharkiv for a few days. And once you get to the city, even though the fighting has subsided and Russian troops have been pushed away to a relatively safe distance, you can see and feel that this is the city at war. There are very few people and very few cars on the streets. The curfew starts at 9 p.m. And when it gets dark, there's no lights on the streets at all. So the city is basically pitch dark at night. We saw the results of a rocket hitting one of the main government buildings on Kharkiv's largest square. The building is completely destroyed. And for us as journalists, even logistically, it was challenging to find a hotel in Kharkiv or even find food because very few grocery stores are open. And there was only one single restaurant open in the entire city of over 1 million population when we were there.
Wow.
So it is indeed still a challenging situation.
How much of Kharkiv's buildings and infrastructure are still standing?
Most of them are still standing. The fighting was mostly on the outskirts. It's nothing to compare in comparison to what was happening in Mariupol.
Well, the battle lines are changing by the day, even by the hour. What can we say about control of Kharkiv itself and the villages surrounding the city?
Yeah, most likely the Russians will not be able to retake Kharkiv. And frankly, from what we understand, Kharkiv is no longer their strategic objective. Ever since Russian troops withdrew from around Kyiv, Chernihiv, and cities like Kharkiv, they did that to concentrate their efforts on the Donbas. The battle for Donbas is happening as we speak. It is very important for Russians to remain control over that strip of land that they have taken control between Russian border and Crimea, creating the so-called land bridge for Crimea, and also taking more land in Donetsk and Luhansk regions.
Well, Russia claims it has advanced to the front lines between the Luhansk and Donetsk regions. Is that claim at all in dispute?
It's not in dispute, but the situation is changing by the hours. There is no clear front line. It's constantly moving. And when even us were trying to get to the front lines positions, when we're talking to military people and asking, can we go to this particular village tomorrow? They say, we don't know. Well, today, this village is still fine. It's still safe. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Volodymyr, you've heard the reports, no doubt, about Russian soldiers retreating from the Kharkiv region and then blowing up bridges. Did you witness any of that activity or the results of it?
Marco, we've definitely heard these reports, and those bridges were blown to the northeast from Kharkiv, very close to the Russian border. When we were in the area, we went to the villages which were liberated from Russians a bit earlier. So we did not necessarily go to these particular villages. But in one of the villages, we still saw a Russian body by the Russian vehicle. So it was very clear that Russians were in that area just very recently.
If Russian soldiers are intentionally blowing up bridges, why would they be doing that? Doesn't that mean their military would have a much harder time getting back to the area?
Well, most likely Kharkiv is no longer on their wish list, and their main target and objective is now Donbas and this big battle for Donbas that is not happening.
Well, in southeast Ukraine, Russia's military has for the most part seized Mariupol, and last night a Russian missile struck the southern Ukrainian city of Odessa. What is the big picture in Ukraine's southeast?
It is obvious both to Ukrainian government and to most likely Russians as well that they will not be able to take Odessa. They just simply do not have enough forces, or they will not be able to take Odessa without inflicting too much damage in the same way they did with Mariupol. So what they are trying to do is they're trying to inflict as much damage to Ukraine's infrastructure for Ukrainian government and Ukrainian troops to feel the pain.
So there's the fighting. There's also these very fluid battle lines that we've been talking about. What does all this mean for escape routes for civilians in these areas?
That's another very challenging situation. 4 weeks ago, even more than 4 weeks ago, when Russian troops started retreating from areas around Kyiv, Chernihiv, basically from northern Ukraine, Ukrainian government urged all of the civilians that live in Donetsk and Luhansk to start evacuating immediately. They knew that these troops will most likely be relocated to the Donbas region, and that's exactly what happened. So for the last 4 weeks, civilians were using mostly railways, Ukraine trains, to try and flee those areas to the western parts of Ukraine, or even here to Dnipro, which is relatively safe. And that's exactly what civilians were doing. If you remember this horrible rocket attack on the Kramatorsk train station, that's exactly when thousands of civilians were waiting for the train to flee the fighting from Kramatorsk to other areas into safety.
What is the actual access that journalists have to see this conflict in these areas in the east and the south of Ukraine?
There's a lot of areas that are not under Ukrainian military control, and Ukrainian military is trying to provide them access and obviously safety for those journalists. And of course, because Ukraine military is concerned about our safety, our access is very, very restricted, and it's very difficult to gain some sort of even access to the front lines. For example, for Kharkiv front lines, we had to negotiate for weeks, and we had to have our personal contact. We knew a soldier in that unit that vouched for us in front of his commander in order for us to get there. So it is very difficult, Marco.
Ukrainian reporter Volodymyr Solohub speaking with us from Dnipro. He returned yesterday from Kharkiv. Thank you very much, as always.
Thank you.
In the Philippines today, street protests about Sunday's presidential election. Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr. won in a landslide, but election observers are reporting thousands of voting irregularities. Marcos Jr. is the son of the Philippines' longtime dictator, Ferdinand Marcos. The younger Marcos campaign essentially rewrote the father's history, and it seemed to have worked. Joining me now is Daniel Davis, a PhD candidate at the University of Virginia. He's studying politics and corruption in the Philippines and joins us from Charlottesville. So to those voting irregularities, Daniel, will they make a difference when the margin between the candidates is so large?
No. Marcos won by an overwhelming margin. Some voting irregularities is not unusual in the Philippines. It doesn't mean it wasn't, you know, some small degree or smaller degree of cheating, but Marcos remains overwhelmingly positive, as well as the vice president who was just elected, the daughter of outgoing President Duterte. Their coalition really sort of delivered a huge victory.
Wow, two dynastic lines. Throughout his campaign, Bongbong Marcos worked to rewrite his father's legacy. Can you give us a before and after here? Like, remind our listeners what the real record of Ferdinand Marcos, the father, was. And what and how did Marcos Jr. revise that narrative?
So Marcos Sr. was elected president before essentially staging a palace coup and declaring martial law and ruling as a dictator for a long time. During that period, thousands were killed in extrajudicial killings. Tens of thousands, by most estimates, were tortured. Some estimates, $5 to $10 billion disappeared into the hands of just the Marcos family, not even counting their cronies. This has been an ongoing project of the Marcos family since not long after they were kicked out. They've worked now for decades to essentially plaster over and rewrite their legacy, which is combined with the fact that these post-Marcos regimes, you know, or governments have not been particularly popular, and sort of one unpopular government after another led to this turn sort of towards this historic revisionism and these more autocratic leaders.
So Ferdinand Marcos Sr. was run from authoritarian power in 1986. There is known and recent history, even a giant bust a la Mount Rushmore of Ferdinand Marcos was blown up in anger after he resigned. Isn't that memory still very much alive for a lot of people in the Philippines?
There's definitely some. I mean, you don't want to treat the people of the Philippines as sort of just one group. Yes, Marcos Jr. was elected with wide support, but there was also, you know, a core of people who were sort of anyone but him and sort of fighting against bringing him back. But there doesn't seem to be as much negative memory today as you might expect. The Philippines has a very young population overall, so some people were quick to point to maybe people just don't remember the Marcos era. But if you look more closely at surveys and the polls, you see that there isn't a big division of support by age group, that he has roughly the same support across different age groups. So people who lived through the dictatorship are not necessarily less likely to support Marcos. So it's not a young versus old thing.
How do you think Marcos Jr. will work to further rewrite the legacy of his father during his presidency? Do you see the project continuing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is an important project, not just to him, but to his whole family. He has, you know, nephews and things that are coming along politically quite fast as well. There was an organization created after the Marcos to try to, you know, get some of that ill-gotten gains back. He's now nominally going to be in charge of it. So he's theoretically in charge of the organization investigating, you know, his family, which he said he won't shut down, though presumably they won't really be targeting him anymore.
Yeah, you mentioned Imelda earlier, Marcos Jr.'s mother. She's facing legal troubles. How does her son's victory affect her case?
It makes it very, very unlikely that she'll ever be punished. The president in the Philippines, even compared to countries where presidents have a lot of power, like the U.S., has a huge amount of power. The patronage politics and the broad powers of the presidency really make it so anyone elected president runs the show, including with the courts, which are usually quite deferential to presidents.
And with the former President Duterte's daughter as the vice president now, I mean, what does all this say about kind of dynastic rule in the Philippines?
It's not just these big families like the Dutertes and the Marcos. Every province has smaller families that dominate in a lot of local places. These are just the families that became big national families. Duterte's father was the governor of the then province of Davao, and his family traces their roots back to, you know, very wealthy people in the Spanish era even. And that's similar for the Marcoses as well. But it's not just these national ones. It's all over the country that you have powerful families running, if not all, then a lot of the politics. So there are other candidates, but in a country like the Philippines where political parties are very weak, it's really family name that sort of substitutes for a political party.
Daniel Davis is a PhD candidate at the University of Virginia studying Philippine politics and corruption. He joined us from Charlottesville. Daniel, thank you very much for unpacking all this.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, people in Shanghai are chafing against weeks of COVID lockdowns. Our reporter there brings us the latest. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This week, Tesla said it was pressing pause on production again in Shanghai. The broken supply chain continues to cause problems there. Then, of course, there's COVID. Shanghai is still under lockdown, with the city shutting down its remaining two operating subway lines. Notably, more and more people are publicly complaining about China's zero COVID policy. Chinese leader Xi Jinping has a warning for them: keep it to yourself. The World's Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai. Rebecca, you've been in lockdown for 6 weeks now. I think most people assumed the lockdown would be over by now. Is there any end in sight?
Well, the numbers of new cases have gone down quite a bit. They were at over 20,000 a day in mid-April, and now they're just under 3,000 a day. Most of these cases are people who are already in some kind of quarantine. So, I mean, things were loosening up. They were allowing people who were living in areas with no new COVID cases to go out of their apartments, even travel in a restricted area. And it seemed like things were coming to an end. But then over the weekend, things tightened up again.
So what are the new restrictions?
Well, all over the city, there are reports of people being told to go back to staying in their homes and to stop getting any deliveries. And if that's enforced, that means people have no way to get food. And there's a new practice that has been put into place, even though it's not official policy. This is a video that circulated online. It's a man in head-to-toe white protective gear announcing, "Don't go outside. If there's one positive case, everyone in the building gets taken away."
Taken away? What does that mean?
Taken to these quarantine facilities. We're seeing all these videos of forced entry and removal of people who have tested negative for COVID. This happened to a friend of mine yesterday. She texted me telling me she had public health workers and the police pounding at her door trying to take her and her neighbors away because of one positive case in her building. She managed to avoid getting taken away, but it was really stressful. The other thing we're hearing about is homes being forcibly disinfected. What happens is all these people in white hazmat suits, they call them big whites, they enter your home and spray everything with disinfectant. They go through your fridge, your closets. It's quite invasive.
Rebecca, how are people responding to all this?
People are very upset. I mean, they're more afraid of a knock at the door than of getting COVID. And in the videos that we're seeing, some are talking back and arguing with police that come to take them away. There was a lawyer and a law professor here that both wrote public letters calling these forced entries illegal and saying they were uncalled for. And people over the weekend were forwarding posts on social media about this, which, of course, kept getting censored.
Yeah, I mean, the public outcry and how it's spreading on social media, that seems really unprecedented. Is Beijing censoring a lot of this? I mean, how much of this is actually getting through and spreading across the country?
Well, you'll see on social media people, you know, sharing posts or sharing videos, and then you maybe go again to look at it the next day, and it's gone. So there's definitely a lot of censorship of what's getting put out there, but there's just a lot of content that people are putting out there. Videos and audio files are getting shared online. And so there's just a lot for the censors, I think, to catch up on.
Well, the situation in Shanghai, where you are, it does seem extreme. What about other parts of China? How are COVID restrictions being carried out in other parts of the country?
Well, in Beijing, there's still no lockdown. The case numbers aren't rising, but they're also not going down either. People there are working from home, schools are still online, and many public places and businesses have been closed around the capital. Meanwhile, here in Shanghai, officials have said their goal is to get the COVID numbers under control by the end of May. They seem to think these new measures will help.
The World's Rebecca Cather bringing us the latest from Shanghai on the ongoing lockdown there. Rebecca, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
It's been a year since protests broke out in Colombia against tax hikes. Dozens of people were killed in the unrest. Now parents of some young dead activists are blaming the police. And those fathers and mothers, they're now taking to the streets to seek justice. Manuel Rueda has more from Cali, Colombia.
At a small park in the city of Cali, friends and family of Nicolas Guerrero staged a concert to commemorate the first anniversary of his death. The graffiti artist was shot in the head during a peaceful protest along one of the city's main avenues. Witnesses say he was killed by police that tried to clear the area using tear gas and live rounds. But so far, prosecutors haven't pressed charges against anyone for Guerrero's death. His mother, Laura Guerrero, says that's why the family is organizing protests in his memory. I don't want any more mothers to have to bury their children, she says. We need justice so that this doesn't happen again. Last year, more than 50 people were killed in anti-government protests that were held from April to June throughout the country. Much of the violence happened in Cali, which is Colombia's third largest city and has some of the biggest income disparities. Human rights groups have collected evidence indicating that police killed at least 25 people as they used tear gas and live ammunition to disperse angry crowds. But so far, only 5 police officers are facing trial for the deaths of protesters last year, and none have been convicted. Government critics say this highlights the need to make changes to the nation's justice system. In Colombia, the National Prosecutor's Office is supposed to investigate cases of police violence, but its director is handpicked by the president.
The fact that we have a prosecutor's office that was appointed basically by the president makes it very hard to have independence, autonomy within the criminal justice system.
Juliana Bustamante is a law professor at the University of Los Andes in Bogotá.
It is ineffective and very slow. I'm very slow in pursuing those public officers that are violating human rights because they represent the government.
In Nicolás Guerrero's case, prosecutors still haven't conducted a forensic test on the bullet that killed him to see if it comes from a weapon used by police. And it's not the only case where they appear to be dragging their feet.
Es que si lo he... Hubo una masacre el 3 de mayo.
Abelardo Aranda says his son was shot in the stomach during a protest in May of last year in Siloé, a working-class sector of Cali. No one has been indicted for his death so far, and Aranda is still waiting for an answer from prosecutors.
Muere alguien del Estado, por lo menos dar recompensa por la muerte de nuestros hijos, siempre los clarifica como...
When someone who works for the government is murdered, you even see them offering rewards, Aranda says. Instead, when our children die, the government says they were vandals or terrorists.
Bueno, saludamos a todas y todos.
Aranda and other parents of youth killed during the protests recently launched an initiative known as the Siloé People's Tribunal, which will collect oral testimonies and videos taken by witnesses at the protests.
Michael Andrés era un joven de 24 años.
The tribunal is led by an international panel of academics, who will review the evidence and issue a symbolic ruling in September. It doesn't have the power to arrest anyone or to order any forensic examinations. But victims of police violence are hoping that this People's Tribunal puts more pressure on authorities to investigate last year's crimes. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Cali, Colombia.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. A museum for families dedicated to language. The founder of Planet Word is on a mission.
My original idea was, how could I do something that would make reading cool again?
And lets visitors experience the beauty and power of language. Plus a Thai restaurant in small town Vermont that's surprising local taste buds. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Yesterday, President Biden signed a bill to speed up military support to Ukraine in its war with Russia.
The cost of the fight is not cheap, but caving to aggression is even more costly. That's why we're staying in this.
Not cheap, and the U.S. is not directly involved in the fighting. President Roosevelt used a similar program in 1941. The Lend-Lease Act allowed the U.S. to send ships, planes, and other weapons to Britain before the U.S. itself joined the fight against Nazi Germany. Lauren Woods is the director of the Security Assistance Monitor at the Center for International Policy. She joins us from Washington. Lauren, let's talk first about the weapons the U.S. is sending to Ukraine. We've heard about javelins and stingers. Describe these weapons and how much each of them actually costs.
Sure. So since the Russian invasion began in February, the United States has given about $3.7 billion in security assistance to Ukraine. It began with lighter weapons. We have seen a lot of anti-tank missiles and that sort of thing. And now we're seeing heavier artillery because of the shift in the battle to the east.
How much is arming Ukraine costing U.S. taxpayers?
The U.S. has spent about $6.4 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since 2014, $3.7 billion of that just since February. Most recently, the Biden administration has requested a package of aid that would include another $20 billion in security assistance for Ukraine and Eastern Europe.
So it might be hard to compare them, but take us to like the comparison of the cost of like the recent 2 months assisting Ukraine and the cost of fighting the war in Afghanistan or Iraq, where the U.S. was directly involved.
Sure. That's a perfect example. Afghanistan was about a $90 billion effort, but that was over 20 years.
Right.
We looked at the numbers of security assistance for the entire world from 2001 into the present, and the average hovers somewhere around $20 billion for the entire world. And keep in mind, this is during often the height of the fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq. This latest security request for Ukraine alone is $20 billion. It's that same number.
Wow, that's incredible. So, I mean, is that a good deal, I guess, is a question.
Ukraine has very urgent needs, certainly. But, you know, we are always thinking about the long-term risks associated with these weapons transfers as well. I mean, you can't have spent time watching Afghanistan, Iraq, other conflicts around the world and not think about the risks, whether it's corruption or whether it's simply keeping track of these arms. That's not to discount the military needs, but it's also to say, you know, we have to do a better job of watching where these weapons go and thinking about the long term.
Well, help us understand that. What could be the future consequences of sending all these weapons to Ukraine?
You know, one of the principles that we always talk about in sending weapons is thinking about the minimum necessary that someone needs in order to fight back. That means you're not delivering weapons that are so sensitive it could create a secondary market. You don't want the equipment to be sold again or to end up in the wrong hands. You're also thinking about corruption all of the time. So certainly those are some of the things that we have seen in nearly every past conflict in which we've transferred very large amounts of weapons.
Well, as Biden said earlier, the cost of the fight is not cheap. He said also that caving to aggression is even more costly. Can you imagine what those costs might be if the U.S. were not arming Ukraine?
I don't envy anyone in the administration who has to make those incredibly difficult calculations on and how much to send. I think our role in civil society is to say, you know, as you do that, as you make those incredibly difficult calculations, you know, to help Ukrainians to save lives, also, please think about the costs down the road and, you know, what Ukraine looks like decades from now, where those weapons are going to be and what they could be used for in the future.
Lauren Woods is the director of the Security Assistance Monitor at the Center for International Policy, speaking with us from Washington and helping us understand the expense of arming Ukraine. Lauren, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Museums are a gift, although sometimes they get a bad rap for being stuffy or too quiet, docents and guards trying to keep the peace. Quiet is definitely not a problem at Planet Word, a museum in Washington that is flipping the script. Planet Word brings language and cultures from across the globe to life. The world's Bianca Hillier paid a visit and has this report.
It's impossible to miss the huge metal willow tree just outside the entrance of Planet Word. Hanging from its branches are dozens of small glass speakers.
And when you walk under them, you hear snippets of 364 languages from around the world.
Anne Friedman is the founder and CEO of the museum.
And they're poems or songs or chants, and it all melds together and creates a real babble of sound.
The interactive sculpture sets the stage for the rest of the museum. It's housed in an old school, originally built in the 1860s. Friedman spent 2 years and $35 million restoring it. She's a former teacher who was concerned about declining literacy rates.
My original idea was, how could I do something that would make reading cool again?
But after brainstorming and consulting with linguists, that question expanded to, how do words and languages shape our lives? Now, Planet Word claims to be the world's first voice-activated museum. Exhibits include karaoke, where you can learn songwriting techniques, and a joke room, which breaks down why something is funny.
I am a computer trying to learn how to write a funny cartoon caption. Can you help me?
One of the main galleries is called Spoken World, where native speakers teach pre-recorded mini-language lessons.
Salam, I'm from Ethiopia, and I speak Amharic.
Shalom, I'm from Israel, and I speak Hebrew.
Ni hao, I'm from China, and my first language is Mandarin.
When I arrived in the gallery, visitor Eli Hiller was working on the lesson from South Africa.
So I was trying a Zulu language that apparently has three different consonants that are clicks, which I'm not really so great at, but trying it out.
Hiller already speaks English, Tagalog, and Spanish. In part, he came to Planet Word for inspiration on what to learn next.
This is like a buffet of languages. So yeah, this is like a good tester for me.
I also spoke with Emily Chambers, who was checking out the museum after moving to D.C. last year. She appreciated learning about languages she hadn't heard of before, but she also enjoyed the lesson about her own native language, Japanese.
It was neat because it talked a little about the Japanese culture and parts of the language that you might use to show that you're honoring someone. I'm like, oh, I'm glad that other folks are learning that that's part of my language.
During our tour, Anne Friedman tried out the Irish Gaelic lesson.
Try it. Say, ni hei.
Ni hei.
That's it.
Friedman says museum goers shouldn't expect to leave their visit with any level of fluency. Instead, she hopes they leave with more curiosity about other languages and cultures. Friedman says her own favorite takeaway has been about Quechua, an indigenous language in South America.
In Quechua, they consider things that are in the future to be behind you.
Elva, the native speaker featured in the museum, explains.
The future is unknown, and we cannot see it. So we say it's behind.
It's the exact opposite of how we refer to the future in English. And I just think that's such a great example of how different cultures express the ideas differently in their languages. And isn't that cool?
For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier in Washington, D.C.
In Sri Lanka today, at least 7 people have been killed in clashes between anti-government and pro-government protesters. The fresh wave of violence follows the resignation of Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa on Monday. This morning, in a military operation, he was whisked away from his residency. Rajapaksa stepped down over mounting anger about Sri Lanka's spiraling debt crisis. They simply don't have the money to pay back its foreign loans. This is a Sri Lanka story, but there's growing fear that this one country could be the tip of the iceberg, the first of many nations unable to pay its bills, as the war in Ukraine creates global economic difficulties. Richard Causal-Wright is director of the Globalization and Development Strategies Division at the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. He joins us from Geneva. In simple terms, Richard, how did Sri Lanka get in this position? Bad management, poor economic planning, corruption, or other factors beyond its control?
Well, I mean, as in any debt crisis, there's kind of multiple pressures on a country, including, as you mentioned, some unfortunate policy moves that the country has taken, reduced in tax rates unnecessarily before the pandemic. It experimented in shifting to organic fertilizers, which was a mistake too. You know, when you go into a crisis like this, you're struggling to generate export revenues. You're still dependent on imports of food and fuel and medicines and capital goods. And you're squeezed, constantly being squeezed. And it doesn't take a lot for that squeeze to become so tight that you simply don't have the resources, the revenue, foreign exchange left over to be able to pay back your debts. And that was essentially the situation that Sri Lanka found itself in at the beginning of this month. It had some big debts pending this year, and it defaulted.
So besides Sri Lanka, what other countries are you concerned about, countries that are also impacted in many of the same ways?
I mean, even before the pandemic hit, there were something like 60% of low-income countries that the IMF deemed were in risk of default or in debt distress. In recent months, with the rise of food prices, the rise of fuel prices, and the rise of the cost of borrowing, there's a number of countries that are being stretched. It's true of a number of countries in Central America. I mean, El Salvador is one country that we have concerns about. It's true of some North African countries. Tunisia is a country that is certainly facing a similar set of combination of factors. And there are plenty of countries, sadly, in sub-Saharan Africa that are facing similar pressures. And this is not the poorest of the poor countries. Many of these are lower middle-income or middle-income countries, as is Sri Lanka.
Well, the International Monetary Fund is working with Sri Lanka. How could a deal help resolve the current crisis?
Sri Lanka desperately needs access to foreign exchange just to be able to import basics. You know, this is not new territory for the IMF. Sri Lanka has borrowed from the IMF on multiple occasions. And our worry with that kind of arrangement is that the policy conditions that are often attached to these loans do not seem to offer a sustainable growth path for many of these countries. They depend on high levels of austerity. They often involve cutting food and fuel subsidies, which often leads to political problems that don't make for a viable and stable economic situation. So it's imperative that a deal is found between Sri Lanka and the IMF. We would be canvassing for a set of policies that don't repeat the mistakes of the past, where countries like Sri Lanka can end up back where they were after entering a program with the IMF.
Richard Causal-Wright is director of the Globalization and Development Strategies Division at the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. He joined us from Geneva. Richard, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
The Northman is a blockbuster movie production with A-list stars, big bloody fight scenes, and a prince seeking revenge for the murder of his father. For a Viking period epic, it has it all. The film, directed by Robert Eggers, also brings something notable for Hollywood, some serious historical accuracy. The world's Joshua Coe noticed that right away and brings us our next story.
I am a pretty big history nerd. Growing up, I was absolutely obsessed with all things antiquity. The Iliad, the Odyssey, Beowulf, that was my jam. And so when the movie 300 came out, I was really excited to see a film depicting the Battle of Thermopylae in ancient Greece.
This is Sparta!
But that movie broke my heart. There was nothing historical about it. Neela Glasel understands where I'm coming from. Her passion is researching how Nordic peoples of the Viking Age actually lived. She worked as a consultant with Robert Eggers on the film The Northman, and she says he nails it.
He's simply a master in creating life in pictures in the movie. He's a big artist, if you ask me. He's amazing.
Now, behold.
Eggers says he spent $90 million to bring the Norse legend of Amleth to life. Amleth, by the way, is also the source material for Hamlet, which is the source material for The Lion King. So this is an age-old story of revenge.
I will avenge your father. I will save your mother. I will kill you if you live.
No spoilers here, but a Norse king is murdered by his brother. The king's son vows to kill the pretender to the throne. And what unfolds is a quest that takes the hero, sort of a Scandinavian version of Simba, the lion cub, straight across the Viking world. And consultant Neela Glasel, she says that Eggers wanted to bring the 10th century alive on the big screen.
We were very much in dialogue about everything in small detail, and Robert is so nerdy, or what shall I say? He goes so much in details, in tiny, tiny small things.
Case in point, a headband. It's the one lead actor Alexander Skarsgård wears in a scene. Here's Eggers explaining the back and forth with Glasel about this small detail in an interview with Vanity Fair.
This headband is made out of something called tablet weaving. I asked Neela, like, you know, could any of the berserkers have, like, leather headbands? And she was like, yeah, if it was Woodstock. And she was very insistent that it would be tablet weaving, and that was what is accurate.
Berserkers, by the way, those were elite warriors of the Viking Age. But not a lot is known about their traditions. So that's where Eggers allowed himself some artistic license. So that right there, that's where the term going berserk comes from in English. In this scene, the berserkers are psyching themselves up around a fire the night before a battle. Jonas Lorentzen is a Danish musician and actor who helped on the music for the movie. He also consulted on this berserker scene.
It's based on a few different depictions of what we might think is some kind of warrior shaman with this horned helmet and the double spears. And the way that they're dancing, it comes from a description of some Nordic warriors called the Varangian god in Byzantium dancing for the emperor. So it's inspired by all kinds of both archaeological and source material.
One compromise in the movie appears to be around hairstyles. Some scholars say that real-life Vikings sported what we refer to today as bowl cuts. But apparently, that was not cool enough for the stars in this film. So these on-screen Vikings all have long hair. Neela Glasel, she says that might not be entirely accurate.
There is stories about King Hofakra. It means king with the beautiful long hair. So it is maybe exceptional that he has this long hair, but we cannot really know.
And despite the sincere dedication to detail, something I personally loved about this film, The Northman has been a slow burn at the box office. In its first few weeks, it's brought in about half of that $90 million budget. For The World, I'm Joshua Koh.
June 21st and summer, just over a month away. If you're looking to travel abroad, you might want to get on that, like yesterday, because a lot of people have the same idea. You may also need to get reacquainted with the travel ropes. More than 2 years into the pandemic, some patterns are changing, creating both travel headaches and opportunities. The World's TBC's Seiya has more.
It's going to be a busy summer travel season. 6 in 10 Americans are planning at least one trip this summer, according to the U.S. Travel Association. Those numbers are pretty close to normal pre-pandemic days. But some things have changed.
So, though there is huge demand for travel, there aren't as many seats or as much capacity as we saw the last normal summer.
Haley Berg is an economist with the travel app company Hopper. She says travelers can expect to pay a lot more for airfares, hotels, and rental cars this year, especially in certain places.
Really, the focus for most Americans is going to be domestic travel or regional travel to South, Central America, or the Caribbean.
She says Mexico and Canada are the most popular international destinations for Americans this summer. Puerto Rico and other places in the Caribbean are also in high demand.
And that's a key difference that we've seen consistently since the beginning of the pandemic. Typically at this time of year, that list is topped by cities like London, Paris, Rome. So it is quite different to see regional destinations from the U.S. topping the list.
Many U.S. airlines cover these regional destinations, but they have been struggling to stop flights, so many have cut capacity to avoid cancellations. Haley Berg says the demand for long-haul flights is not as high, so this might be a good opportunity for Americans looking to go farther from home.
So for travelers who are looking to go on a long-haul trip, maybe to Europe or to Asia, prices are in line with 2019 levels. The more regional destinations are a bit more expensive.
Many European countries, including Italy, Spain, and Greece, have relaxed entry requirements. But there is not a single policy that applies to all countries in Europe. What is a factor in many countries right now is inflation. That's actually the top concern for American travelers, according to the U.S. Travel Association. COVID-19 is not as big of a concern for many people, but some worry about testing positive while they're overseas. That's because there are restrictions for re-entering the U.S. without a negative test. Tori Emerson is with the U.S. Travel Association, and she says this policy discourages foreign travelers from visiting this country.
There's really some significant inconsistencies in this policy that are clearly not based on science. So it's time to move past these COVID-related policies and move to an endemic state. The virus is here. We're going to have to learn to live with it. We shouldn't be requiring this pre-departure testing.
Some health experts would disagree with that, but there is no sign yet that the Biden administration is ready to drop those restrictions. In the meantime, people in the travel industry say they expect airfares to go up, and they say it's a good idea to book your summer vacation trip sooner than later. For The World, I'm TBC's Seiya.
Our final story today takes us to a small town in Vermont, Randolph, population 5,000. A chef from Thailand is making a bet there on spice and major flavor. Instead of well-known dishes like pad thai and red curry, she wants to challenge her customers' palates. Michaela Lafrac from Vermont Public Radio has our story.
In an old blue Victorian mansion on a hill is Sop, a Thai restaurant run by Nisa Chung Morgan and her husband Steve. They've offered to cook me up a couple dishes before the lunch rush hits.
What do you want to make, honey?
What do you want to eat? I want to cook for you. Eat.
I don't know.
You can look. Give her a menu.
I start looking over the menu. Most of the dishes you'd find at a typical Thai restaurant in the U.S. were popularized in Bangkok, like pad thai. Nisa Chung Morgan, who goes by Room, is from the northeast region, called Isan.
We eat food really different from Bangkok, you know. Mm-hmm. Bangkok use coconut, you know, but we don't use coconut too much.
Only Isan is rural, hot. Its cuisine often features fermented and pickled vegetables and meat, epic spice levels, courtesy of chilies, and lots of sticky rice. Rung picks out one of her favorite menu items to whip up, an herbaceous chicken soup called Tom Yum Gai Isan. The broth is somehow both sour and sweet. It's flavored with the kitchen's holy trinity of lemongrass, kefir lime, and galangal, a ginger-like root. I taste some and swoon.
Rung, so good. I'm so good. Thank you.
Rung and Steve Morgan started the restaurant together as a way to share their love of cooking. Steve worked as a chef and cooking instructor. The two met online about a decade ago on the dating site Match.
And so after Skyping for about 6-7 months, I got a ticket to Savannakhet Airport, which is the big airport in Bangkok. And Rung met me there with bags of mangosteen and lum yai and long kong.
Steve started falling for the food in Isan at the same time he was falling for Rung. Their visit went well, and after a couple more, Rung and Steve got married, and she moved with her daughter to Vermont. She got a job cleaning rooms, and at night, she'd tell Steve about her dreams.
And she kept saying to me, you know, I don't want to keep cleaning rooms. I want to have a restaurant.
I tell him, I want to open Thai restaurant. I want to open Thai restaurant.
So they took the leap. They rented a space and selected a Thai word for their new restaurant's name, Sop. Steve first heard the word on one of their visits to Isan.
It means delicious. So when we went there and everybody was sitting around the table with the sticky rice, going, Sop, Sap Lai De.
Sop, sap, maple syrup, you get it. They decorated their restaurant with a quirky mix of Thai and Vermont decor. Red plaid curtains here, Buddhist statues there. Rung wanted to include some well-known Thai dishes on the menu to attract customers, but Steve pushed to stick to their vision.
I knew if she cooked food like it was from home, and we paired it with local beer, local cider, people would drive for it.
There was one dish they could not agree on, pad Thai.
We fought a little bit about, I was like, we're not going to have pad Thai on the menu. But people expect it. They come
people
to a Thai
love
restaurant.
Pad Thai, no? People love pad Thai.
Whatever she's doing seems to be working. She recently found out she's a finalist for a prestigious James Beard Award for Best Chef in the Northeast. And even though Vermont and Thailand are so different, she says she's not homesick. What she is busy. Lunch customers are about to come in, so I get the rest of my food to go. For the World, I'm Michaela Lafrak in Vermont.
And that's our cue to go. If you want takeaway from the show, we're online anytime at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.